Les colloques du Collège de France.
It's my pleasure and my privilege to chair this first session in the beginning of this international conference on racial borders. I am very pleased to first introduce Ms. Achiume. To me, Ms. Achiume is an author of a fascinating article in the Stanford Law Review about migration as decolonization, which will correspond to the topic of my next course in 2023. It's a fascinating article because she establishes the underlying basis of the exclusion of migrants in our legal conceptions. But it is not exactly the topic she will address today. And I don't want to take too much time and then give her the floor immediately. Professor Achiume, the floor is yours.
Thank you so much. Can you hear me?
Yes, very well.
Okay, lovely. Thank you so much for that generous introduction. And thanks foremost to Didier for the invitation and the privilege of accommodating my inability to travel due to health reasons. Didier, I'm a very big admirer of the work, and you've assembled a phenomenal group of scholars, and I'm very sad to miss everybody. So the aim of my keynote is to pick up where Didier left off. And in many ways, our comments are going to be very much aligned. And to make the case that a pressing global challenge, including for international legal scholars, my own background is an international scholar, but for other scholars of borders of migration, and just for the general population, the argument I'm going to be making is that there's an urgency to reframe border and migration debates to account for contemporary borders as sites of imperial injustice and inequality. And I will elaborate on that and what I mean by that over the course of my presentation. The challenge, of course, that is not just about reframing debates. Reframing debates, to my mind, is an essential precursor for the ultimate challenge, which is to remake our borders to undo the injustices that they entrench. And in my remarks, I'll actually be drawing on both of the articles that have been mentioned, Migration as Decolonization and Racial Borders, for those of you who are interested in more detailed accounts of the arguments that I'm making. So let me begin by setting a timer so that I don't talk forever, which is something that I definitely have been known to do. So I will start my timer here and begin with an example that helps illustrate what's at stake. So on June 24, 2022, some of you will remember that Moroccan and Spanish border guards killed between 23 and 37 African men as they and a group of others attempted an unauthorized crossing of Morocco's land border with Spain in Melilla, which sits on the north coast of the African continent and is itself a very complicated colonial history. Many others were injured, and the video images of the violence and its aftermath are very difficult to watch. At the time that this was taking place, I was actually serving as the United Nations Special Rapporteur on Contemporary Forms of Racism and was receiving video images of the violence and its aftermath, which were really difficult to watch. Bodies of living, injured, and dead persons piled on top of one another as border guards kicked and prodded them to ensure that they were subdued. I briefly considered showing some of these images as part of my presentation, but decided against doing so. Dehumanizing images of spectacular border violence against Black and Brown people are by now commonplace. And as another author, William C. Anderson, has put it in the context of racial violence in the United States, dead Black people are not ornaments to be put up and taken down for every activist, need, purpose, or point. So I refrain from showing any of those images. According to the reports at the time, there were hundreds of Black Africans who had gathered to attempt the crossing at Melilla. And also, according to some reports, they were armed with sticks and stones and other handmade items. In the aftermath of the incident, the Spanish Prime Minister called on NATO to recognize unauthorized migration of the nature manifest at Melilla, as a threat to arguably the most politically, the most powerful political and military security in the world, alliance in the world. In his argument, it warranted joint action. So in other words, he was making the case that unauthorized migration must be a priority concern for NATO. And he was successful. And indeed, by July 6, 2022, a media outlet reported that NATO forces, including troops from Spain, Britain, Belgium, and the United States, had conducted exercises along EU member state forces of the Spanish and North African coasts. Most debates, especially legal debates, treat borders themselves as immovable facts. They just are. And to the extent that they have any kind of ethical valence, it's one of neutrality or one of righteousness. We think of borders in international law as just entitlements of nation states. In its invocation of NATO, Spain cited national and regional security threats to the EU's borders, implicitly treating these borders, which include the borders of its African enclaves, Melilla and Ceuta, as uncontested. In this and many contemporary public debates regarding migration, borders are rarely themselves the source of ethical conundrums. Rather, it's the movement of people or the policies that governments then adopt in response. And to the extent that debates take seriously the idea of changing the ways that borders work, arguments that weigh in favor of admitting migrants in legal debates remain rooted in humanitarian and solidarity concerns. So when we're thinking about admission of refugees or other people who are fleeing extreme hardship, we think of humanitarian and solidarity as the main modes of making those arguments. The edgier ones may make claims about equality, but very rarely is justice the dominant mode of challenging the border, let alone justice in the context of empire. And so the title of my keynote today is Racial Border Injustice. And the specific focus, as I mentioned, is racial border injustice. And so I'm going to say a few words about the word race and the sense in which I'm using it, fully endorsing also the conception of race that Didier provided in his introduction. The work of decolonial scholar Annibal Quijano reminds us that race today is the product of centuries-long colonial intervention and exploitation, during which, and I quote him here, race became the fundamental criterion for the distribution of the world's population into ranks, places, and roles in society's structure of power, end quote. In the colonial context, then, race structured rights and privileges on hierarchical terms that were determined by white supremacy. Although formal decolonization has occurred in most, though not all, of the world, race persists as a neo-colonial structure, one that still allocates benefits and privileges to the advantage of some and the disadvantage of others, largely along the same geopolitical and racial lines that characterize the European colonial project. This is by no means a totalizing account of the meaning of race. Race means so many different things in so many different contexts. But what I'm zoning in on is a particular conception of race that I'm going to argue has global salience. And of course, race is not a biological fact. It's instead a social construction that has persisting meaning and effects. And many of those meaning and effects remain the product of the modern colonial origins of contemporary racialization as a global project. In the time that I have, I want to focus on borders with a lens that highlights race and empire. And when I use the term empire, I'm going to use it roughly to refer to social, political, and economic interconnection among sovereign nations. So think about interconnection among sovereign nations, but on fundamentally unequal terms that benefit powerful nations while structurally disadvantaging and exploiting subordinated nations. So when you think of empire, you can think of colonialism, you can think of neocolonialism, you can think of capitalism as forms of empire. And I want to invite you to consider borders in particular as racial imperial technology. And what I mean by this is that borders operate as a means of extracting value from bodies and regions, including through racialization, and they do so on unjust terms that systematically benefit imperial hegemons. So race isn't only about self-identification, but it serves as a mechanism for entrenching hierarchy and even profit accumulation And it does through border regimes, including border regimes that seem facially race neutral. I'm going to be talking about how race works through borders and how race itself is also pivotal border infrastructure. And so I invite you to think of law in this way as a form of technology as well. And I hope to show how thinking of borders as racialized imperial technology helps us articulate in more precise terms the injustices that borders perpetuate and also perpetrate. My analysis privileges race, but I want to be clear that there are other systems and structures like gender, disability status, class status, that all operate as borders and that law is implicated in facilitating the bordering. And they do so in different ways. And so although my analysis is not of the intersectionality of different systems of imperial subordination, I do think that kind of intersectional analysis is important, even though I don't engage in it here. So turning now to the concept of racial borders, when you think about the much reviled illegal immigrant, so when you conceptualize who the illegal immigrant, I would guess that for most people, the illegal immigrant is a racialized subject, and not just in Europe. This is the case the world over. Whether we're talking about so-called illegal immigrants in the United States, in Europe, in South Africa, illegality of migration is in its most contested and polarizing forms. It typically implicates the movements of non-whites. And again, race is not the only basis for contested migration, but globally, it's an important factor. And unfortunately, the problem of racism and racialized exclusion is a problem that's embedded in international and domestic legal frameworks, many of which are treated as facially neutral, and many of which are actually treated as existential features of liberal democracy. So the problem of racial borders, I'm going to put it to you, is a problem that is at the heart of how we conceptualize liberal democracy. I've used the term racial borders in my work to refer generally to territorial and political border regimes that disparately curtail movement and political incorporation on a racial basis. So if you're thinking about movement or mobility, or political incorporation and membership in the nation, racial borders do the work of disparately curtailing movement and incorporation on a racial basis. And essentially what racial borders do is that they sustain international migration and mobility as racial privileges, among other privileges that we might associate with borders. And so I argue that contemporary national borders of the international order, the argument that I'm making is about the international order as a whole, even though my examples will focus on Europe, these national borders are inherently racial, and a default manner in which they enforce exclusion and inclusion is racially disparate. And furthermore, these racial disparities structurally benefit some nations and some racial groups at the expense of other nations and other racial groups. So the disparities aren't arbitrary in terms of how they allocate benefit and harm. And as a result of legal doctrine that was developed in the service of specific imperial and colonial projects, which were initiated in the past and persist today, I'm especially interested in how whiteness in particular confers privileges of international mobility and migration, and how proximity to whiteness calibrates these privileges. And so what I'm going to try and do is map out in the briefest terms how these racial borders operate. But in doing so, it's important to start with history. And the history that I'm going to give you is a much abbreviated historical account. To any of the historians in the room, I apologize, but it's for the purposes of time that I'm going to be so brief. If we think about the period between just the 19th century and the first half of the 20th century alone, approximately 62 million white Europeans emigrated to colonial territories across the world. And historians note that the scale and consequences of even just British Empire migration alone between 1815 and the 1960s explains much about the modern world. Colonial economic migration brought with it genocide, enslavement, and exploitation that transformed the world and laid the foundation and basis of our current global order. And in striking contrast to the deadly cost that international law imposes on non-European migrants today, European colonial migrants benefited from an international and imperial legal regime that encouraged and celebrated white economic migration. European imperialism in the 19th century played a crucial role in producing the migration and mobility regimes that we should understand as the progenitors of contemporary regimes in the present. And those imperial regimes operated in a way that meant that the large-scale international mobility of Europeans and non-Europeans across imperial territories was a function of race and the economic needs and political desires of metropolitan and settler colonial nations. With slavery's abolition in the first half of the 19th century, the global imperial economy could no longer rely on the brutally coerced migration of enslaved Africans for its labor supply. This shift thrust Indians into the role of the global working class of the British Empire, as millions were contracted as laborers to work across the British colonies in the Caribbean, in the Southeast, South Africa, and the Pacific. Millions of Chinese were also recruited to work in the Dutch, Spanish, and British empires. British treaties, for example, recognized and protected certain forms of mobility and migration, even for non-white people, and for the purposes of imperial prosperity. So you have examples of treaties that were actually concluded to allow freedom of movement for Chinese, for example, as an exception to the Chinese emperor's prohibition on migration at the time. And this was to allow these workers to operate in these other empires as well. As late as the mid-19th century, again, providing an example from the British Empire, migration and immigration in particular was mostly unrestricted. By the late 19th century, however, immigration restrictions that would ultimately implement a regime of racial segregation on an international scale, with British self-governing colonies, including the United States, leading the charge. This is a process that historians have described. Within and across these colonies, conceptions of a universal right to freedom of movement gave way to more rigorously defended Republican discourses. And here I recommend the work of historians Marilyn Lake and Henry Reynolds, who in their seminal book, Drawing the Global Color Line, inspired by the work and thought of W.E.B. Du Bois, basically chart the spread of whiteness as a transnational form of racial identification that was, as Du Bois noticed, at once global in its power and personal in its meaning, the basis of a geopolitical alliance and a subjective sense of self. This racial identity was forged in the context of 19th century imperial projects and the mass migrations that attended them. And a transnational community of white men in this period bolstered border protection regimes and the doctrine of national sovereignty. So, for example, in the 1970s, the United States restricted naturalization to free white men. In 1855, the British self-governing colony of Victoria, which would later become part of the Federation of Australia, introduced the first immigration restriction in its Chinese Immigration Act, which defined an immigrant as any male adult of native China or its dependencies or any islands in the Chinese Sea or any person born of Chinese parents. Furthermore, techniques of racialized border exclusion were perfected in national jurisdictions before being launched transnationally. So, for example, national segregationist technology that was used, such as the literacy test to disenfranchise Black voters in Mississippi in 1890, would later be transferred from that context to immigration restrictions in the context of preventing non-white migration, first to the United States and then in South Africa or Natal at the time, and then other British dominions as well. At the level of legal doctrine, the late 19th and earliest 20th centuries were also periods in which an absolutist conception of the sovereign right to exclude was crystallized. So there is a popular conception and a legal doctrinal conception of the right to exclude of nation states as being almost absolute and being very robust. And this conception of crystallizing of sovereignty is actually fairly modern. It crystallized specifically to underwrite the exclusion of Asians, especially from white settler colonies of the British Empire. The Chinese exclusion cases decided by the US Supreme Court in the 1880s are a key component of this legacy, legitimating a national settler colonial project defined in racial terms. prior conceptions of sovereignty doctrine had accorded foreign nationals mobility and migration rights, but these prior conceptions were revealed to be racially contingent. And Eve Lester's doctrinal analysis of early international law tracks how, in the works of international legal theorists such as Grotius, Vittoria, Pufendorf, and Vattel, the rights-bearing foreigner, she says, was always and anywhere a European insider. But with European colonial expansion, and I'm quoting her here, she said, it was the appearance of the foreigner as a racialized non-European figure, the desire to regulate her labor that led directly to the emergence of restrictive migration laws and then a common law doctrine of absolute sovereignty. In a comprehensive historical study of modern borders, Adam McEwen further shows how the most basic principles of contemporary border control were initially developed in the white settler nations, especially between the 1880s and 1910s, and that such controls would eventually become, and I'm quoting him now, universalized as the foundation of sovereignty and migration control for all states within the international system. So my analysis has focused on the British Empire and the British Dominions. And part of the reason for this focus is that a lot of restrictions that originated there ended up globalized by finding themselves into international legal doctrine. But there are other legal scholars, such as Thomas Spikerbore, for example, who are focusing on other European empires and the evolution and the mutual constitution of borders through race and imperial projects as well. And I recommend Thomas's work for those of you who are interested in histories, including French legal histories that are related to these topics. And as somebody who doesn't read scholarship in French, unfortunately, I cannot recommend any literature in French that would be appropriate for our audience here. But I will say that the racial implications, the racial stakes implicated by national border governance in the colonial era were perhaps most vividly illustrated in the fate of what would have been the first international treaty or the first international agreement governing racial equality that was proposed by Japan for inclusion in the founding charter of the League of Nations. This is following the end of the First World War. So in February 1919, in the lead up to the formation of the League of Nations, Woodrow Wilson joined others in the Anglo-American alliance that presided over the rejection of this proposal by Japan. This proposal would have required all members of the League of Nations to grant, and I'm quoting here, to all alien nationals of states, members of the League and equal, just treatment in every respect, making no distinction either in law or in fact on account of their race or nationality. And so basically, at least for nationals of members of the League of Nations, the idea was that neither race nor nationality could be a basis for any distinctions in law or in fact. If this had been adopted, this proposal would have enshrined racial equality between nationals and non-nationals in international law, at least for international migrants who were members of the League of Nations. Now, the British settler colonial nations ensured the rejection of the racial equality clause, the US and Australia taking the lead. And for these groups, the racially constructed threat of Asian migration was perhaps the most salient concern. These nations, the US among them, feared that international standards on racial equality would give international bodies jurisdiction over issues such as immigration and naturalization. Immigration and naturalization, which were deemed regimes of control over access to the benefits of colonial exploitation, were thus regimes to be shielded from external scrutiny, especially scrutiny that might insist on principles of equality and non-discrimination. As Anam Sumru notes, the Anglo-American alliance sought to remove matters of immigration and racial discrimination from international scrutiny and challenge, and they sought to do so through international legal doctrine, specifically the invention of the doctrine of domestic jurisdiction. And for those international lawyers in the crowd, you will know that the doctrine of domestic jurisdiction remains central to international legal doctrine to this day. This interwar period turned out to be a period during which racial governance was deeply embedded into regimes of migration governance. And this embedding was done in ways that used facially neutral doctrine. So when you look at the doctrine of domestic jurisdiction, it doesn't say anything about race. It doesn't say anything about racialized forms of exclusion, but it originates as a mechanism for protecting certain regimes, such as immigration, from scrutiny along lines of racial equality and racial injustice as well. So I've provided only a barely cursory account of the history of racial borders, a history that's much deeper and much more complex. But there's two points that I want to highlight about this history. The first is that border and migration governance regimes were mechanisms for enforcing racialized access to benefits of colonial exploitation. And so what you see is these border regimes, these racialized border regimes, were at the heart of political and economic empire. And the second point that I want to make is that even in this era, in the colonial era itself, forms of racialized form exclusion were perfected through facially neutral legal categories and doctrines. And in my scholarship, I map the ways in citizenship, the ways in which citizenship, nationality, and even sovereignty doctrine, as it relates to the right to exclude, all facilitate racialized forms of exclusion that we have to grapple with. We can't continue to treat these concepts as neutral. So what bearing does this history have on the present? And I want to focus the remainder of my remarks to think now about the present. In November 2017, I want to again provide another vignette that can help anchor some of the intuitions that I'm trying to drive home. In November 2017, media outlets reported the deaths of 26 Nigerian girls and women aged between 14 and 18, whose bodies were found floating in the Mediterranean. There were many more individuals on the boat that carried them, including some survivors. One of the survivors who was interviewed stated that the motivations for most of the women on the boat from Nigeria was the search for jobs. So Europe, like much of the first world, and by first world here, I use that term to refer to former colonial powers, is powered by most of these former colonial nations are powered by economic systems that are predicated on labor migration and arguably even unauthorized labor migration. But rather than provide legal pathways for these types of migration, European nations, with the support of African and governments, I have to underscore, have doubled down on the securitization of European borders and even of African borders to keep migrants out. In the context of passports, visa regimes, border externalization and securitization policies that in effect privilege the mobility of citizens of former colonial powers, the reality is that the deadly cost of international migration is largely a non-white problem. It is neither arbitrary nor coincidental that the 26 girls who perished were Black. And the same is true of those people who perished at Malia's borders, who I spoke about at the beginning. In effect, as Nicholas DeGenova has pointed out, Europe's borders are racial. And my point here is that we can think about international borders more generally as having these racial effects as well, because of the work that international legal doctrine does to structure all borders, not just the borders of Europe. The borders between imperial hegemons and the regions that they have historically exploited remain racially circumscribed graveyards as a result of the contemporary system of racial borders. And so whether we're talking about the Mediterranean, whether we're talking about the US southern border, when we think about imperial hegemons and the regions that they've historically exploited, the borders between them really do entrench systems of racial borders that are profound. Take, for example, the current Schengen visa regime. And I talk about visas because we tend to think about visa regimes, again, as neutral in terms of racialized forms of exclusion. We tend to associate racialized forms of exclusion with the illiberalism of politicians such as Donald Trump or Viktor Orban. But I want to talk about the Schengen visa regime, reminding everybody in the audience that Europe is home to the former colonial powers that divided Africa up for their benefit, and that I mentioned are mobilizing NATO against Africans and other migrants. In 2002, all of Africa was on the visa blacklist. And it was called officially the blacklist, but it was referred to as the blacklist and the whitelist, even though that terminology has fallen away, thankfully. Today, the only African nations on the visa exempt list are Mauritius and Seychelles. almost all of Asia is on the blacklist, whereas all of the North America and most of Latin America is also on the white list. These visa lists amount to a system of racialized national profiling, according to which nationals on the quote blacklist must on an individual basis work to overcome their presumptive exclusion via visa applications that are adjudicated through processes that by law are characterized by broad discretion that is barely insulated from racially infused decision-making, implicit and explicit. For example, a recent parliamentary report focusing in the UK, on the UK in particular, found that African citizens who applied for British visas were twice as likely as the average applicant to be denied a visa, and seven times more likely than a North American applicant. Obstacles to approval included poor quality and inconsistent decision making by visa officers, disregard for individual circumstances, strict but inconsistent documentation requirements, and an apparent institutional presumption that African visa applicants, particularly those with limited financial means, intended to violate UK immigration laws. And what you see is that the single most common issue brought to the report's author's attention was the denial of application because of the requirements to prove the financial circumstances of the applicant. So some of you might be thinking, okay, this is about class. This is about trying to keep out a group of people who, because of their class circumstances, we might think of as more likely to violate immigration laws. And I want to point out that class and race are mutually constitutive. When we think about the economic conditions of the African condition, even in the present, the African continent, even in the present, we can't think about those economic conditions without accounting for the role that race and racialization have played in securing African economic subordination. But what was interesting about this report is that it found that even when Africans were able to provide unequivocal evidence of financial means, so either they were able to prove that there was a bank account or there was an inviting institution that guaranteed the financial costs of these individuals, many were still denied visas, right? So your identity as an African was so presumptively understood to be likely to lead to illegality that even proof that you had financial means couldn't overcome that presumption. The report raised concerns, among other things, about gender and racial discrimination and prejudice in the visa decision-making processes. Visa studies are very difficult to come by. And for the social scientists in the audience who are studying visas, really eager for you to publish those papers and make them available, especially to lawyers. And there are some studies that look at the EU's visa regime as well and ask these kinds of questions about the role that discretion plays in resulting in racialized forms of exclusion. Now, the racialized closure affected by visa regimes has another facet, and I'm going to continue with the example of the United Kingdom, but the United Kingdom is not alone in this respect. So when you think about visa restrictions, they don't apply to all Africans equally. More to the point, Africans of European ancestry who are de facto white can use their bloodlines to circumvent restrictions that apply to other Black co-nationals. For example, a 2010 study mapped the visa regimes that facilitate access of white South Africans to the UK and Europe. The author of the study identified a number of visa categories available to South Africans based on historical colonial relationships between South Africa and the UK, including something that's called an ancestral visa. And the ancestral visas or things like them exist in different parts of the world. It's available to South Africans with a grandparent, and in some cases, a great-grandparent born in the United Kingdom, and it grants the bearer 5 years of work authorization with a pathway to citizenship. Africa's formerly settled British colonies, including South Africa, Zimbabwe, and Kenya, all have citizens with grandparents and great-grandparents who were born in the UK. Almost all of these qualifying citizens, at least today, are likely to be white. So if you're a Zambian or a Kenyan, for example, being Black or white can determine whether you can travel and what type of visa you're going to need to go to the UK. And this means, in effect, that the benefit of the ancestral visa is allocated on a racial basis to whites, even though British imperial subordination decimated the worlds of so many non-white Africans, right? So ancestry and bloodlines continue to trump the political and economic forms of interconnection and subordination that I argue continue to bind former colonial powers to the nations that they colonized. And so the point I'm trying to make here is that justification of this differential access to the UK can neither be divorced from empire past and present, nor from the meaning of race as a structure of imperial privilege. And so the bottom line is that these visa regimes are not race neutral, and that borders remain shaped by empire past and present. And in my article, Racial Borders, I describe in more detail how international law, and especially international human rights law, continues to protect racial borders by creating exceptions that typically would not apply except when you have the intersection of race and foreign nationality. I want to further invite you to consider the ways in which race itself operates as territorial border infrastructure. So I've been talking about a system of racial borders historically and in the present. I've focused my remarks on thinking about the roles that visas play in this contemporary system of racial borders. But what I'd like you to do now is think about race itself and the ways that it operates as territorial border infrastructure. So you can think about walls, you can think about fences, and I want you to think about race as performing in even more sophisticated ways the work of territorial bordering. And I want to begin again with a historical example or a historical anecdote and then connect it to the present. On July 27th, 1919, a Black teenager named Eugene Williams was swimming in Lake Michigan, Chicago, a city that at the time was fraught with racial tensions among Blacks and whites, including as the result of the great migration of African Americans who were fleeing the inhumanity of the Jim Crow South and the segregation that was being implemented there. So Chicago itself didn't have an official system of racial segregation, but racial tensions were nonetheless still high. Now, while Williams was swimming in Lake Michigan, he inadvertently drifted into the part of the water that was unofficially considered to be a whites-only part of the lake. Chicago was not formally segregated, but its territory was without a doubt racial. Space and rights were informally but effectively demarcated on a racial basis. A beachgoer, a white beachgoer, outraged by Williams' act of trespass, began throwing rocks at Williams. And we might think of this as an act of punishment, but it was also an act of border enforcement. Williams drowned that day. And in the aftermath, several Black witnesses urged police officers who were present to arrest the white man responsible for Williams' death. He refused to do so. And according to one report, tensions on the beach escalated, a skirmish ensued. And when the officers arrested somebody, it actually ended up being a Black person instead. This event triggered 6 days of protests and racial violence, sometimes referred to as the Chicago Race Riots of 1919, the biggest massacre of Blacks by white supremacists across the United States during the Red Summer. Now, Williams' death occurred in 1919. This is the same year that the United States, along with Britain and other former dominions, especially Australia and South Africa, were working hard to consolidate what W.E.B. Du Bois described as the color line. And so the history of the Racial Equality Clause of the League of Nations treaties that I was referring to earlier, those negotiations were taking place the same year that these events took place. And Nicholas Wiseman has argued that both the Chicago race riots of 1919 and the British Anglo opposition to this international agreement were triggered by the perceived impact of migrating people. In the former, it was the migration north of Black people that universalized the kind of anti-Black politics that had previously been confined to the south of the U.S. And then the rhetoric of white Chicago included calling on states in the South to keep its Blacks. So basically in Chicago, they were saying Black people needed to stay in the South. And I would say that if we think now about debates within the European Union, there's a similar argument about keeping Black Africans out of Europe. including through fatal migrant interdiction policies in the Mediterranean. So what I want to do is, notwithstanding the many differences between the United States and the European Union, and notwithstanding the many differences between the experiences of Black people in 1919 and Black and other non-white people who are trying to cross the Mediterranean now, I nonetheless want to say that there are some connections that we should have in mind. For Williams in Lake Michigan, even in the absence of any physical barrier designated to police access on a racial basis, and indeed, even in the absence of any individualized assessment of who he was and what rights he might have had in Lake Michigan, his Blackness, the specific social, political, and legal inscription, legal construction inscribed in the color of his skin, operated as a border. Blackness designated him as an interloper and made possible, and for some people, probably necessitated his fatal stoning as a border enforcement or as a punishment for trespass. There are no white men throwing rocks at the Nigerian girls whom I mentioned died in November 2017. The Mediterranean is, however, policed by Libyan coast guards funded by the European Union to push migrants and refugees back to Libya, where they are detained in EU-funded migrant detention centers. And again, although there are no white men throwing rocks at Black African migrants and refugees in the Mediterranean, European countries have gone so far as to criminalize aid, even by human rights and humanitarian organization, aid to those migrants and refugees in these waters, preventing the otherwise inevitable deaths of migrants and refugees in these treacherous waters is punishable by law. Whereas creating the conditions and providing resources that result in the deaths of these migrants and refugees is not. The Mediterranean, and this is a point that Didier made in his introduction as well, is among many is many things to different people, including a site of racially determined death. For the 26 Nigerian girls or the African men killed at Melia, their race was as much a reason for the means of their exclusion from Europe as was the physical border machinery that bounds Europe. As Black people, part of the social construction of their racial identity in the context of neocolonial empire is the mark of presumptive outsider subordinate or subordinate insider status, where the nations of former colonial nations are concerned. Access to Europe is mediated by facially neutral but racialized migration policies combined with pervasive racial profiling in immigration enforcement, such that the very bodies of Black people and other non-white people operate as borders. And this is at stake in the meaning of race itself. I recall being in Morocco. Part of my work as special rapporteur in the UN, which I mentioned earlier, involved country visits. And I did a country visit to Morocco. And I remember distinctly the experience of traveling by road from the south to the north of Morocco and witnessing just visibly a decline in the number of Black people in public spaces, and realizing that that had to do with the fact that the closer you get to the borders with Europe, the closer that you get to Tangiers and the north of Morocco, the more aggressive the racial profiling in immigration enforcement. That means that Black people, as Didier was mentioning in terms of immigration enforcement, are stopped, are checked, are prevented, are arrested, irrespective of, in some cases, of the documentation that they may have. So I spoke with migrants and refugees and even Moroccan citizens who would say, sometimes the documentation doesn't matter, your skin is doing all of the work. And this is at least one of the senses in which I'm saying we have to mark race itself as border infrastructure and as operating in ways that that promote territorial or enforce territorial and political borders. And when we think about racial and border injustice, and when we think about remaking racial borders, part of what we have to be doing is pushing for a different meaning of what race is in the world today. So I was going to talk a little bit about why I think we have to use the language of injustice. It's foreshadowed in my comments, but because I'm running short of time and want to give time to Q&A, I'll just say a few words about this. We often think that exclusion of non-nationals is just because citizens are entitled to the benefits of the nation, whereas non-citizens are not entitled to the benefits of the nation. When you zoom out from the nation state and you consider instead imperial formations, if you think about colonial empire, if you think about neo-colonial empire, and if you think in particular about the ways in which former colonial powers remain bound to former colonies, and in the ways that just imperial hegemons remain bound to the countries from which they exploit and extract. And here I'm thinking not just through state intervention, such as military intervention. If we want to think about the displacement of Afghans, we can think about the role of former colonial powers, the United States including, in destabilizing Afghanistan. In my work, I've argued that there are forms of imperial domination that sustain the kinds of bonds between those who do the dominating and those who are dominated, that essentially undercut any kind of ethical justifications for the right to exclude. When we think about a Zimbabwean who was subject to British colonial domination and who lives in a nation that still is reckoning with that legacy, I've argued in my work that that person has to be understood as fundamentally tied to the United Kingdom. And we think about France and we think about its colonial history and we think about people who live in territories that were formerly colonized by France. We have to understand those bonds as being bonds that keep people bound on unjust terms. I want to layer over that the account of racial borders that I've been providing you to say that forms of racialized exclusion, which seem to be driven by no invidious intent by any particular immigration official, forms of racialized exclusion that seem structural and that are about the disparate or statistical implementation, all of these regimes are taking in place in a context of imperial interconnection that, to my mind, result in racial border injustice. And so I think that part of the ways we have to reckon with systems of racial borders is to also think very deeply about the injustices that are embedded in them and to think about how borders sustain apartheid-like conditions on a global scale. So I will end here with the final statement that I think remaking borders has actually really about remaking systems of interconnection. We have to overcome the predations of global capitalism, patterns of extraction and exploitation and consumption that are fundamentally unsustainable, but that also rely and on and fuel racial border injustice as well. Thank you so much for your indulgence. 45 minutes is a long time to listen to one person speak, especially on a screen. So I'm truly, truly grateful for your attention. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Professor Tendai Achiume. I have to signal the fact that it's about 1:30 a.m. in the western coast of the United States, and you succeeded in delivering a very vivid presentation. We'll, of course, we'll be pleased to have to read more carefully all the extensive presentation you made, fueled with example, fueled with quantitative demonstration, that was very convincing. And well, once again, thank you so much.
Retrouvez tous les contenus du Collège de France sur www.college-de-france.fr.